think, maybe she's on the edge of the desk.
Yeah, okay.
Good morning, everybody. I think that we need to start. We are running late already. So I welcome you all to this forum on ethics and values. As you know, radiation protection is based not only on science, but also on values and experience. And I am Sisko Saloma. The rapporteur of this forum is Hans Riot. Hans, you can come here. Unless you rather wish to see. Okay, you need to see them. You're right. So we have four distinguished speakers for this forum, and I'm very pleased to welcome the first speaker, Dr. Claire Cousins, the chair of ICRP, to discuss the ethics in medical radiological protection. Please, Claire.
Thank you very much. I hope everyone can hear me and that the microphone is working. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to be asked to take part in this session. What I'm going to do this morning, I think, is give you a presentation more with my medical hat on, probably than with my radiological protection hat on, but hopefully by combining the two, just to highlight what I see are some of the major issues and challenges in medical radiological protection. So, but first of all, I'm going to mention very briefly what actually is, what do we consider is medical ethics, how do we protect the patient, which includes justification and informed consent, optimization, and just a little on DRLs, and just finally a little bit on where I see we need to improve medical education as part of the ethical radiological protection issues that we face. So first of all, what are medical ethics? Well, if you're a doctor that qualified as long a time ago as I seem to have done, then you did actually have to swear the Hippocratic Oath. Most modern doctors nowadays do not. And the Hippocratic Oath has had lots of different translations over the years. Basically, what it's saying is you should do no harm to the patient. And I thought for radiological protection, I consider for the benefit of my patients and abstain from whatever is deleterious and mischievous was probably quite appropriate. So again, what are medical ethics? Well, they're really, like any other ethics, a system of moral principles that apply values and judgments, of course, to the practice of medicine. And what that means is it really the entire practical application of the way we do practice medicine, but there's a considerable overlap in addition to the other disciplines that, of course, have to also take a part in medical practice, and this is sometimes areas of sociology, philosophy, etc. So quite broad and encompassing. So there are a few core values that, as doctors, we need to consider. First one is autonomy. Really, the patient does have the right to either choose or refuse, and they must be actively involved in their treatment wherever possible. Beneficence really means that the doctor should act in the best interest of the patient. And of course, when it comes to using radiation, this is very important. Non-maleficence really means first do no harm, and this is what comes back to the Hippocratic Oath. In justice, we like to think that there is fairness in the distribution of health resources and equality of treatment, and that we must respect the person or the patient, and they do have a right to be treated with dignity at all times. And it's also very important that doctors need to be truthful and honest. And again, I will come back to this when we talk about informed consent. So there may be some of the core values, but which ones really then are the most important if we're considering medical radiological protection? Well, I think they are the beneficence, the non-maleficence, and truthfulness. And this is something which I think doctors at the moment are probably quite bad at, is actually informed consent, and particularly with regards to radiation and radiation doses that patients might actually receive. So when it comes to radiological protection of the patient, of course we have justification, we have optimization, but we do not have dose limitation. We like to think that we are actually doing our best for the patient at all times by using justification and optimization, obviously, alone. So justifying medical exposures. What do we mean by justification in medicine? Well, as in all aspects of medical practice, we should be reviewing the benefits and the risks to make sure that we are doing more good than harm. And again, in practice, what this generally has to rely on is the doctor's professional, the professional's experience, their knowledge, their judgment. But quite often it comes down to using a lot of practical common sense and looking at the patient overall, not just as a disease process. So we have three levels of justification. We do assume in medicine that radiation now does more good than harm. We have the generic justification of defined procedures, be it chest x-rays, fluoroscopic examinations. But what we still must not forget to do is have justification of a procedure for an individual patient. And this is particularly applicable to if we are doing complex diagnostic or even more so interventional procedures. And things that need to be considered are, is the x-ray or the procedure really necessary? And this is again when I'll come back to the fact that I think we need to look at the patient as a whole, and I'm going to raise some other issues with that in a moment. If it is really necessary, will the result actually change the management of the patient? And again, I'll mention another concept, which is nice to know disease. As doctors, we do generally like to act as detectives, investigators. It's nice to know, but you may put the patient through some particularly unpleasant investigations or treatments, and it may not actually always be in their best interest. And when using radiation, we should not forget that there may be an alternative investigation, particularly if the patient's had multiple investigations, that we should consider using non-ionizing radiation with ultrasound or MRI. And then I'm going to come back to again the issue of informed consent and what we should actually say to the patient with regards to radiation. So is the x-ray really necessary? Well, I'm sure we would like to think so, but sadly that is not always the case. A lot of x-rays are done really without any good justification whatsoever. Is the x-ray really necessary? Well, I think we find in modern day practice that defensive medicine, of course, does sometimes play quite a large part, and that does mean that we do unnecessary investigations that we maybe would not have been doing otherwise. Many patients these days do seem to come back to hospital on many occasions. They have repeated admissions, and what we do seem to find is that they have the same tests repeated even if they were negative on a previous visit. This, of course, probably applies mainly to x-rays, chest x-rays and abdomen x-rays, but increasingly CT scan is being used again as a sort of screening tool when the patient arrives in hospital. Certainly here in the UK, we find that with the working hours and the directives, that there are actually different clinical teams may see the patient when they come back on repeat visits, and they have a different group of junior doctors, all of whom reflexly just start the process all over again. And I think what there also is often when there's not sufficient time sometimes is that there's not enough discussion between the referring doctor and the practitioner, i.e. the radiologist, as to what actually is the best investigation for the patient or the best treatment, and more to the point is, again, is it really necessary? This is just one very brief example from my own hospital. This is a gentleman who's 32. As you can see, he's already had 107 x-ray attendances, and he's had numerous CT scans. The coding on the side, C is a CT scan, F is an x-ray, I is an intervention, and this is how frequently he's coming to hospital. Now, he has got kidney stones, undoubtedly, but most of the time when he comes to the hospital, he probably requires some analgesia and to be made comfortable and then to be sent home and not to have a CT scan on every single occasion. But that's just one example of maybe way we do not appropriately justify medical procedures. So, again, is the x-ray really necessary? We have to accept that the risk of the radiation effects in elderly patients is largely very much outweighed by the diagnostic and therapeutic benefit. We don't want to get away from the fact that most patients do actually benefit considerably from the procedures that they are actually receiving. But there is an increasing use of more complex treatments using fluoroscopy, again, to treat the more elderly, the frail, with these minimally invasive techniques. And they are still at risk from actually suffering tissue reactions, skin injury from these high-dose interventional procedures. And these can be devastating for some of these more elderly and frail patients should they actually sustain these injuries. So we still, just because they're old doesn't mean to say that you can keep doing the same tests without any risk. So will the result change management? Well, as I say, we're quite good at doing nice-to-know disease. And this is particularly on the very elderly patients. And I think sometimes the doctors that request certain investigations or treatments actually don't know what the investigation or treatment entails and what the patient may actually be having to go through to complete it. I think we find increasingly that even the terminally ill and those that are having palliative care are still being put through some, high dose procedures. Again, the dose doesn't matter, but procedures that you could say probably are not justified given their prognosis and their disease. And there's also something I'd just like to mention to you is the question of incidental findings or vomit. You may think, what on earth is vomit? Well, vomit is a victim of modern imaging technology. And this was described by, in fact, a British neurosurgeon in the British Medical Journal 9 years ago in 2003. And this is his scenario is that patients come, of course, with one symptom. You do a test. You don't find the disease that you think you're going to find, but what do you find? You find something else. And then that leads you off on a trail of what may or may not be important investigation, sometimes not, and then the patients may actually come to harm as a consequence of what you've been doing. And this is just one example in a moment I'm going to show you. And this is, as I say, will the actual result change the management? Again, not always, but we do encounter such scenarios not that infrequently. And this is my example of a vomit case. It's a youngish person who came with pain in their upper abdomen, and their general practitioner thought they may have gallstones, so they sent them along for an ultrasound scan. They did not have gallstones, but they had this, I hope you can see, sort of bright, round lesion in their liver. And someone thought, oh, that's probably a benign tumour, but could it be a malignant tumour? So the patient got a CT scan, which is here. And the pattern of the enhancements on the CT scan does show that this is benign. It's what we call a hemangioma. But the radiologist reported it, sadly said, it's probably benign, but it could be a tumour. And so, unfortunately, then the patient had a biopsy. Someone decided to stick a needle in it to take some tissue out to check. The reason it's a hemangioma is because it's full of blood vessels, which means then it bleeds. So the patient then bleeds torrentially following their biopsy. The hemorrhage can't be controlled. They have an arteriogram to try and control it. That doesn't work. The patient has an operation and ends up having the right side of their liver resected. So this was someone who only came with a bit of pain that was probably not due to anything significant. It certainly wasn't due to this lesion. And this is where we can start a cascade. And once the patient's along that cascade, we should stop at each step and actually consider, is what we're doing actually justified and in the patient's best interest? So, is there an alternative investigation? Well, many patients do require more than one test, it is undoubtedly true, to complete their diagnostic pathway. I've already mentioned, should we be using more of ultrasound or MRI? And probably we should. Certainly here in the UK, MRI may not be readily available for all indications, particularly out of hours. And what we find that the more junior doctors tend to do, they ask for CT anyway because they have this belief that there will be more diagnostic information from the CT than maybe ultrasound, which is, of course, a little bit more operator dependent. Coming on to informed consent. Most procedures that patients have done, even if we actually know that there is going to be quite a high radiation dose, it is still not commonly used as part of the informed consent process. But we have to accept that this does have to be increasingly important, and particularly if patients are going to actually return maybe for more than one procedure. So I think it's my general impression, certainly, as I say, here in the UK, that it's seldom discussed. Part of the problem, I think, is because the practitioners themselves who are going to undertake the procedures are not actually aware of the radiation doses and then not really aware of the radiation risk themselves, so they're probably not able to appropriately consent the patient. And then, of course, there's always the worry that, well, if I tell the patient about the radiation, then they may turn around and say, well, I'm not sure I should go through with this. And then will the patient be refusing or be denied what could be an important treatment? And so getting the balance is actually is difficult, but important. And we have touched on this in ICRP publication 85, where we did talk about patients should be informed of possible high doses and skin effects if a high dose is being delivered. They should be aware that skin effects can actually be delayed, and this is not something that will be evident usually by the end of the procedure. But more to the point, if the patients are coming back for multiple procedures, then the radiation dose is additive and we should be even more cautious. Something else that we mentioned in 85 is that the patients themselves should be told about the signs and the symptoms of the effects and really what to do next, because very often the patients will not present back to the radiologist or the cardiologist who has actually performed that procedure. They may actually then present to their general practitioner, who may not recognise what's going on. And generally, we don't discuss, certainly don't discuss any risks of malignancy, but we should do, because more and more minimally invasive high radiation dose procedures are being performed on young adults and children. This is particularly cardiological procedures. And we may be actually exposing the organs that are then going to be more at risk of malignancy, particularly the breast, the thyroid, etc. So moving on to optimization and DRLs. We should always be thinking about optimization for the patient, and this should be really at two levels. Have we got the right equipment, and has it been appropriately installed to do the job that we actually want? And then the way we use the equipment and on whom we use it and what we use it for is also important and needs to be considered. And of course, this brings us on to the keep the radiation dose as low as practically achievable, but then you do have to make sure you are using enough radiation to actually answer the clinical question or for the medical purpose. There is no point dropping the dose where you've still irradiated the patient, but then the images are not good enough to make a diagnosis. And so that one thing that manufacturers often tend to do is leave a piece of equipment with what they call factory settings. And it's then really up to the staff to make sure that the manufacturers do leave the equipment in a fit state, as I say, to actually treat the group of patients for whom the equipment is meant. And that's particularly true of paediatric patients. There should always be regular quality assurance of the equipment. And one thing that I think, again, has been realised over the last few years is that it is not appropriate just to use an adult imaging protocol in CT for children, because then they really do need to be modified. And if you do not modify your protocol, then actually you can get it very wrong indeed and deliver very high doses. So what we want to do then is we have to have a mechanism for actually looking at the way that we are actually, or the amount of radiation that we are actually delivering. And that's where the concept of diagnostic reference levels, or DRLs, have actually arisen from. And these are to help us avoid giving any radiation dose that really we feel is not contributory to the clinical purpose. These are derived from local, regional, or national data. And what they're meant to do is to have an optimum range of values for a specific imaging task. Now, that does mean sometimes there are difficult patients, there are large patients, there are ones that become unexpectedly complicated. So this is not for the individual. This is for each individual patient. It's for a range of procedures. So this is what it's actually meant to actually be looking at. But we want you all be looking at not just doses that are above particularly the reference level, but you may find that some procedures have persistently low doses. And again, this is where we may not actually be acquiring appropriate images to answer the clinical question. And so this is to compare examinations and not individual patients. And I know there's a lot of work has gone on all around the world with these, certainly here in the UK. We've had national surveys of patients' doses that was started by NRPB, as it was in the early 1990s, and this database is reviewed and updated every 5 years. And I think all hospitals should be using these and find the data very useful. In particular, we should use them, as I say, for specific groups, and paediatrics is one of them. And the equipment's performance and their technique can be significantly lowered, I think, if one is very fussy in the way you treat paediatrics. This is obviously easier in big, super specialised paediatric hospitals, of course, where they're dealing just with paediatrics and children all the time. And it's certainly been noticed and reported by the group at Great Ormond Street that they can actually make their fluoroscopy doses 5 to 25 times lower than the national DRLs. Now, there's not to say that every other hospital will be able to do with it, but probably with some effort they could actually improve it. And something that's risen its head recently, again here in the UK, has been the concept of a hospital radiation league table. Now, ethically, quite where we stand with that, I think, is rather difficult. This comes from the fact that there was a child who was treated in a private London hospital for a fluoroscopic examination of the bowel, and the child received a very high dose because it wasn't done by a paediatric radiologist. And so it then all got hit in the papers. The mother found out about the dose and not surprisingly was very concerned. And so this is when, the papers have actually realised that maybe we should have hospitals producing all their results. And I think there could be arguments for and against it. Would it actually improve hospitals' performance? Would it help to drive up standards? I don't know. We've been there with education, but I think it's something that will probably not go away very quickly. DRLs have been developed for interventional procedures, say particularly in the US and around Europe. These have been developed for many cardiological and interventional radiological procedures. One thing that's quite difficult in this is because, it's quite often hard to predict quite how the therapeutic procedure will go. And considering the size of the patient has also become quite difficult in the analysis. But nonetheless, there are these papers and more literature is coming out on this. So just finally, I'd just like to talk a little bit about medical education. Because I think one of the real difficulties is actually educating the medical profession as regards to radiological protection. Radiation is being used outside the X-ray department, but the problem being is that teaching these doctors on radiological protection is expensive and we don't have much resource in many cases. So very quickly, there's a study that was done in the BMJ in 2003. They asked doctors in two UK district hospitals about radiation and doses. None of the 130 doctors asked knew anything about the dose from a chest X-ray. 4% scored zero in the questionnaire. 97% markedly underestimated the dose. Somewhat worryingly, 5% of them thought ultrasound used ionising radiation and 8% thought that MRI did. So this was only, in 2003. It's no better in Turkey, where they asked, again, in university hospitals, very similar results. 4% didn't know the dose, underestimated the doses. 4% thought that ultrasound used ionising radiation, and 27% thought that MRI was using ionising radiation too. So I think the knowledge of doctors is on radiation doses is appalling, and I think it's probably up to us as the radiological protection community to see if we can actually do better, and we have to make an effort to do this. I'm not going to show these slides because this is just to say what ICRP is doing, but as we're running short of time. Yes. So finally, to finish, ethics in medicine is, like in many aspects of life, is a very complex issue, but it's something that cannot be ignored. We know that a lot of the technology we have offers huge benefits of care for patients, but we do not have to forget the radiation doses and the ethics and the protection that goes with it. As I said, I think it's our duty to try and educate other doctors to improve their knowledge. And of course, our fundamental principle as doctors still has to remain, do no harm. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to leave the questions towards the end of the session to catch up the schedule. Our next speaker is Jacques Lechard. He's currently director of CEPN, the Nuclear Evaluation Center. He's chairman of ICRP Committee 4 and he was executive officer of IRPA during the last 12 years. Please, Jacques.
So do I have something to do here? Okay, good. Thank you. Good morning, colleagues. I'll try to very briefly introduce you to the one aspect of the ethical basis of the system of radiation protection, which is the precautionary principle. To begin with, I just quote, I like this quotation from Lauriston Teller, just to remind you that ethics was at the heart of the reflection of the pioneers of radiation protection. And there is, this is important to remind you that, I think, because now ethics seems to be quite popular. We have more and more sessions about ethics in our conferences. And it's interesting to note that there is no real conceptualization or formalization of the ethical principles that underpin the system of radiation protection in ICRP publication, although these principles are quite present, are there. I'd like to note also that there is a more recent interest for such conceptualization and formalization. There was a very interesting debate in the early 90s following the publication of a paper by Persson and Schrader-Frechet on the ethical principles underlying the protection of workers. There was all a series of articles in scientific journals. They are very interesting. More recently, of course, there is the developments in connection with the CRPPH workshops on science and values in radiological protection, the first one organized in Helsinki in 2008 by Cisco Saloma, our chair, and more recently in Vaucernay, and there will be a third one in Japan in fall, next fall. And it's obvious that there is also an increasing questioning from some NGOs and even the public about the ethical foundation of the system. Just for your information, because of this background, ICRP has decided to create a working party within Committee 4 on the ethics of radiation protection last fall in Bethesda. Just a few elements to remind you that, in fact, the system of protection is has a scientific basis, you know, epidemiology, biology, anatomy, physiology. And thanks to this basic scientific, this scientific basis, the system is providing key quantities, risk coefficients, detriment dose, equivalent effective dose, dose criteria. And the fact, it's important to know that to arrive to these quantities, there are many value judgments, and some of them are related to ethics. I'm not going to touch that today. And we have, of course, the principles, the basic principles that were reminded by Claire just before. And I think this is important to note that there are key, what I call, I have no better name, what I call the key values of the system. And if you think justification, optimization, limitation, and so on, and you relate this to the quantities, you see that there are three key values: prudence, precaution, reasonableness, reasonably achievable, you know, ALARA, and tolerability. And you have all the science condensed into quantities which are in fact driven by value judgments, these three key values. And I think one possible, one route for exploring the ethical foundation of the system is just to this question mark here, you know, to say what is behind these values? Where they come from? Are these values universal? What are the key ethical principles behind these values? And this is how I think we could enter into this exploration about the ethical foundation of the system. In two slides, I just want to give you, to to remind you about the basics of ethics. This is not the purpose of this presentation, to go into the basics of ethics. But there are three key domains of ethics. The meta-ethics, this is the study of the moral concepts, judgments, reasoning, underlying ethics. There is the normative ethics, the examination of moral standards about how human ought to behave. And there is the applied ethics, like, for example, the medical ethics, as we just heard before. Just a remark, ethics is this is the Greek term, and in Latin this is moral. So ethics equal moral. But people tend to use more ethics than moral, because moral has also another connotation. So what we are dealing with clearly is the normatic ethics. And here, once again, we have three key branch of ethics. One branch which is called consequentialism, and in fact, this is moral, what is promoting common good. What really matters are the consequences of human actions on the well-being of people. This is a focus on the consequences of actions. And there is a sub-branch of consequentialism, which is utilitarianism ethics, which is very well known in our profession, because this is the basis for cost-benefit analysis, for example. The second branch of ethics is deontological ethics. And moral is what is accomplished according to duties, whatever the consequences. So this is the focus on duties and rules. And virtue ethics is moral, what is perfecting human beings as virtuous agents. Focus is on attitude and behavior. Of course, it's not no time this morning to explore all that, but our system is based on these three, is embracing all the ethics, all the existing ethics, because we focus on the consequence of what we do, we focus on duty, we have rules and duties, and we focus on, and we also promote good attitude and good behavior. Precaution. There is a very long tradition about precaution. It is in the old time, people used to use prudence. The term was prudence, or the Greek phronesis. But now in modern language, we talk about precaution. A long tradition from Aristotle in Europe, but also in the Buddhist tradition, in the Confucianism, in the ancient people of Oceania and America, you can find this key value, and this will be discussed later on this morning. Precaution is clearly a virtue. It is how to behave without the full knowledge of the consequences of our actions. This is old as the world, you know. People act, but they don't know exactly what will be the full consequences of their actions. And this is really something which is at the heart of the human behavior. So precaution relates to the virtue ethics, if you want to go back to academic work and explore what is precaution. The object of precaution is what is contingent, which means what can happen or not happen, what is occasional, accidental, uncertain. Precaution is the virtue of deliberation, the disposition to choose and act on what is in our power to do or not to do. So this is clearly related also to practice. I think it's very interesting to search where precaution was introduced first in ICRP publication, and this was in 1950. Here again, radiation protection was probably pioneering all the thinking about precaution in the following decades. You know, precaution, the debate about precaution is quite recent. After the Rio conference, for example, this was very popular and there was a lot of things. In our constitution, we introduced the precautionary principle in our constitution, in the French constitution, a decade ago. But you see, ICRP, it was already in 1950. Whilst the values proposed for maximum permissible exposures are such as to involve a risk which is small compared to the other hazards of life, nevertheless, in view of the unsatisfactory nature of much of the evidence on which our judgments must be based, coupled with the knowledge that certain radiation effects are irreversible and cumulative, It is strongly recommended that every effort be made to reduce exposures to all type of ionizing radiation to the lowest possible level. You know, unsatisfactory nature, uncertainty. We are dealing basically with uncertainty, and we may also be facing irreversible effects. And this is the key. There is the potential for irreversible effects. We have no clear scientific answer, so we have to act, to behave in a virtuous way. 1950, it's amazing. And here, it's just to simplify, because we could discuss a long time. But what is behind that? This is the famous Pascal's wager. You know, this is the thinking about the French philosopher Pascal about, does God exist or not? Do we have a risk or not? You know, this is more or less the same. We have a large uncertainty about God because we have no evidence about him. So we have no evidence about low doses, the risk about low doses. So we are facing a dilemma, uncertainty. Do we have a risk? We have uncertainty. Do we have a risk? Do we have no risk? And we select, we want to be prudent. Why? And this was the reasoning of Pascal. I put it in very simple words. If I bet there is no risk and it turns out that there is one, I can only have regrets not to have behaved correctly. If I bet there is a risk and it turns out that there is no risk, I have no regret with regard to the risk. Of course, I have maybe spent money and so on, but with regard to the risk, I have no regret. So the adoption, and on one side, you may think about people that died, on the other side, spending money, resources. So here, it's clear that the adoption of a prudent attitude minimizes regrets in case of a wrong choice. And this is what is behind the system of protection. I don't go into the details, but just to mention that there was a long development in the ICRP publication about how to put this basic ethical attitude into practical way of managing radiation protection. And you can find in ICRP publication 9 the key points there, which are still there in our more recent publications. The mechanism of the induction by radiation of leukemia and other types of malignancy is not known, uncertainty. Such induction has so far been clearly established after dose of more than 100 rads. So you see, science is coming into the picture, you know, to help. But it is unknown whether a threshold dose exists below which no malignancy is produced. You know, this is the classical situation in which we are all the time. Now, of course, we have much more scientific information, but this is exactly the same problem we are facing. Also, because of the lack of knowledge of the nature of the dose effects relationship in the induction of malignancies in man, the Commission sees no practical alternative because we need to take action. We cannot say we don't know, so let's wait until we know. So we have to act. So how to do it? No practical alternative for the purpose of radiological protection to assume, you know, this is a bet, to assume a linear relationship between dose and effect, and that doses act cumulatively. And then the consequence of that is, as any exposure may involve some degree of risk, the Commission recommends that any unnecessary exposure be avoided and that all doses be kept as low as readily achievable. You know that by heart. But you see the logic there. And so, I very briefly, one slide, the implications of precaution, because we could expand that for a long time. Maintaining exposures below a limit is not a guarantee of no risk. That was a real change in 1950. You know, because before, the limit was a guarantee that there is no risk. And suddenly, this is not anymore a guarantee. And then it means that limitations of individual doses, of course, the term is not there, limitation of individual doses becomes an issue of tolerability of risk and equity. It's not anymore a problem of finding a threshold, it's a problem of what is tolerable, what is equitable. So you see how you enter also in another branch of ethics. Risk-taking Another consequent implication of precaution: risk-taking is justified only if there is a benefit in return. This, and then you open the door of the justification of decisions. If you know that there is no real value for doing something, you don't do it, because this is application of precaution. Once an activity is justified, and this is the reasoning of ICRP, how far to reduce the risk, how not to jeopardize the activity, because at the end of the day, we want to get the benefits. What criteria to use to base decisions on the right level of protection? And then you enter into the world of optimization, the world of optimization of protection. This is what I could call the quest of reasonableness. And here again, you have no magic number for what is reasonable. This is a matter of appreciation. This is a matter of behavior. This is a matter of attitude. And now, in modern terms, we talk about radiation protection culture, because this is what is at the heart of our system. To conclude, the radiation protection system is a construct. This was recalled by Cisco Saloma in the beginning. The radiation protection system is a construct that combines the state of knowledge on the effects of radiation, ethical values, and feedback experience. Precaution is certainly a cornerstone of the edifice. It allows to take into account the inevitable limitations of radiation science in order to act virtuously. There are also many procedural aspects of the implementation of the precautionary principle, which fall within the ethics. I will not enter into that, but for example, it was already mentioned in the previous presentation, the right to know, the informed consent, even the engagement of stakeholders is linked to the precaution. And this would be very interesting to really elicitate all this in the framework of the working party of ICRP, but also through conferences, sessions, and so on, because people have to understand all these values behind our system. The precaution, and I will also very brief here, the precaution also implies a duty of vigilance. We don't know, so we have to do all efforts to know. But as we don't know, we may have bad surprise, but we may also reduce the uncertainty. We want also to reduce the uncertainty. So there is two duties on us: a duty of disease surveillance of exposed populations. And for example, I remember the discussions we had just after the Fukushima accident. There was a discussion, should we really put in place a detailed follow-up of this population or not? Maybe we are going to introduce some stress in the population because the risk is not that big, but it's not the problem. The problem is how to imply properly the precautionary principle. We don't know. We have still uncertainties. There are people who are at risk. There is a duty to do a proper surveillance of these people. And there is also a duty to pursue relentlessly research in the field of epidemiology and radiobiology. We cannot give up. We have to try to reduce the uncertainty and do all efforts to do it, because this is the root of the system. The uncertainties are there. We don't know how to act. And we have to act, and we have to do it in a proper way. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jacques. I think that we will again leave the questions for the end of the session. Our next speaker is Dr. Frido Zölzer. He's from South Bohemian University, Faculty of Health and Social Studies, and Jeske Budejovici. And he has interest in ethical issues in environmental health. Please.
Yes, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, let me start by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak about my favorite subject. Especially I would like to thank Jacques Lochard, whom I met last year in the International Congress of Radiation Research, where we also had a session about ethics, and then we discussed different things, and he suggested it might be interesting also for this audience to discuss something about cross-cultural approaches to questions of ethics. It has been mentioned that the moral philosophy underlying the radiation system of radiation protection, the recommendations of the ICRP, is not always made explicit. Of course, clever people have extracted or have found their principles from different origin, from utilitarian ethics, from deontological ethics, from virtue ethics. But actually, that doesn't make us much happier, because if you look at moral philosophy, to talk to moral philosophers, they will tell you that these are incompatible moral theories. You can't put them together because they are based on different priorities. Utilitarianism is based on usefulness, it looks at the consequences of what we do, and it looks at the usefulness of what we do, and decides that what we have to do is the thing that is useful, that is producing more happiness than pain, or more the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people, or whatever. Whereas deontology is about duties. Deon, Greek, means duty, and my duty is what can be universalized, what can be applied by everybody. That's the famous categorical imperative by Immanuel Kant. Act only according to that maxim or that principle, by which you can at the same time wish that it would become a universal law. So if what you is your principle of action at the moment can be considered a principle for everybody, then it is something that can be considered your duty. But these two don't always go together. And so in moral philosophy, utilitarianism and deontology are mutually exclusive, but yet we are putting them together, or some it is suggested that we derive certain principles of radiation protection from the one or the other theory. My question here is a bit more fundamental. Is it at all appropriate in a more and more globalized world to base the recommendations of an international advisory body such as the ICRP on particular theories of Western ethics? After all, utilitarianism and deontological ethics, of course, have their roots in older theories, in even antique thought, but they were developed at the end of the 18th century, and they are certainly concepts that have grown in a Western European context. If you look at the statistics, sorry to bother you with this, but I think it gives us a perspective of the world today. The population statistics of the world, if you count together all the Europeans, all the North Americans, let's say also the Latin Americans and the Australians, it is about, 25-30%? But more than 50% of the world's population are living in Asia, and another 15% in Africa. And they are not necessarily versed with the concepts of Western ethics, and they are not necessarily happy about accepting this kind of thought as their basis. It doesn't mean that they would necessarily disagree with all the principles of radiation protection, but they would probably not relate to the ethical basis that we are offering, or that have been offered. Or if you look at distribution of religions, of course, these concepts of Western ethics have grown in a Christian context, but partly in opposition to church teachings. But nevertheless, if we just look at how widespread Christian thought is, then it is about 40% of humanity, but we have 26% Muslims in the world, we have 18% Hindus in the world, we have, according to this statistics, 8% that follow Chinese traditional religions. Maybe it's more, because the statistics, of course, in China is very difficult. Another 8% Buddhism, and so on and so forth. So Western thought, I think, cannot be the exclusive basis of our system of ethics, any system of ethics, be it ethics in general, or applied ethics, or radiation protection ethics. This is my first statement, or my first thesis. In the world today, in a globalized world, we cannot exclusively argue with Western arguments. Now, the next question then is, do different cultures have fundamentally different approaches to moral questions, or is there something like a common morality? And here we can go back to something that has already been mentioned, namely a system or a framework that has been introduced into biomedical ethics by Beecham and Childress in 1979. Their book on principles of biomedical ethics has gone through 6 editions now. The 6th edition came out in 2009, I think. So 30 years of tradition of these 4 main principles. Some people in biomedical ethics call this the Georgetown mantra, because it's repeated all over again and again and again, these 4 principles: autonomy, non-maleficence, beneficence, and justice. And what is interesting to me here is that Beecham and Childress assumed that these 4 principles are rooted in a common morality, which is not relative to cultures or individuals, because it transcends both. Originally, these 2 people were not really interested in different cultures. If you look at the first, I think, 3 editions of their book, they don't mention different cultures. I think they don't even mention common morality. They were just interested in finding middle-level principles that they both would be able to agree to. And that was significant because Beecham was originally a utilitarian and Childress was originally a deontological philosopher. And they could agree. They found out that they could agree to these 4 principles, although they came from different backgrounds. Now, it is very important that they didn't contribute, let's say, Beecham 2 of these principles and Childress 2 of these principles. It is not that some of these principles came from utilitarianism and some came from deontological ethics, but they found out that both could agree to these 4 principles for different reasons, but still they could find this middle ground where they would agree, without referring to a more fundamental principle such as usefulness or universalizability. The 4 principles have prima facie validity, which means that they apply as long as there is no conflict between them, because now you have 4 principles in their own right. All of them are have the same right, these 4 principles, and you have to, if they are in conflict, you have to balance them, and that's not a matter of on the fly, I think they write in their book. The principles also need specification. That is, they are very broad and they have to be specified in different contexts. They have to be brought to the practice, which is also a difficult task. All of this is a matter of long discussions in Beecham's and Childress' book. I cannot go into the details, but it is interesting that there is 30 years of tradition of discussion how to balance these principles and how to specify them in different contexts. So my second statement, or my second proposal to you, is this approach of Beecham and Childress could become a model for ethics of radiation protection, in that we try to identify relevant principles in the common morality. My own approach differs a bit from the one proposed by Beecham and Childress in 2 aspects. One is, how do we find these underlying principles of common morality? And the second aspect is, how do we actually do the balancing and the specification in different contexts? Just briefly to this one, Beecham and Childress are not really interested in the sources of common morality. They just claim that all persons committed to morality, that is their wording at the moment, changed over the years, all persons committed to morality would agree to these 4 principles. And they don't go into the details and try to find it in different cultural backgrounds. And this, in my view, is not sufficient, is not satisfactory. I think we have to go back to the written and oral traditions of different cultures, and we have to see if they contain such principles. And because these oral and written traditions are still of great influence to people not versed in Western secular philosophy, of course, we are in the West, we have been going through a process of secularization, and we don't look so much for guidance in the written traditions of our religion, for instance, but a majority, I would claim, of the world's population still does, and we cannot ignore that. Fundamental documents, then, for our search for common morality are the holy writings of the different world's great religions, also documents produced by way of intra and inter-religious dialogue, because it is not necessary, or it's not necessarily so that, let's say, Catholics and Protestants would read from the classical documents the same things. So it would be interesting to look at ecumenical documents. There's also a lot out there about interfaith dialogue, so people from Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, having been together and tried to distill from their traditions common morality, if you wish. I think we should include time-honored philosophical works such as those of Confucius and Aristotle. Now, of course, that's a matter of discussion. What is time on it? Does it have to be 2,000 years or is 200 years enough? But anyway, I think we cannot exclude these philosophical traditions. And also we should look at oral traditions of indigenous people, you know, Native Americans or Australian Aboriginals and so on. So I think we should not look for common morality by conducting an opinion poll throughout the world and say, what do you agree with? But we should go deeper. We should look at the guidance that people have had through the centuries, the written and oral traditions that have been available and are still available in the different cultures over the ages. Beecham and Childers, this is my second point of deviation from their concept, suggest that the principles found in the common morality are anchoring points of a process which leads to or approaches a reflective equilibrium. So you take the principles, you apply them in different contexts, you compare that with your moral intuitions, then you may change it here and there, and you find a system which is equilibrated and everything fits together. But this is basically a project, a reflective process. You can do it principally in your own chamber, or a few philosophers or a few specialists can do that together in their group. Whereas I think if we really think of cross-cultural ethics, we need to understand how people in different cultures understand these principles, how they balance and specify these principles in their everyday life. And this is why we need to talk to each other across cultural borders. We need to lead a cross-cultural discourse, and only then we can develop this rough selection of principles into a real cross-cultural ethics. So this is something, of course, coming from maybe a German Habermasian tradition. We need to talk to each other. We need to communicate. We need to have discourse. Anyway, whatever you do to construct this common morality, we are here talking about the principles of radiation protection. And my question now, in the last part of my talk, is can the principles of radiation protection be related to those found in common morality, especially assuming that the principles of Beecham and Childress are really part of the common morality? Can they be of use in the context of radiation protection? I think yes. I will make it very brief because this would require detailed discussion and more in-depth analysis. But I do think that the first two principles, justification and optimization, are related to non-maleficence and beneficence. Non-maleficence, don't do any harm, and beneficence, be of benefit to people. And I think if we look at how these principles have been understood over the centuries, we would find out that everybody would agree that you have to justify. You cannot just do things harming people and not producing benefit. And also optimization, I think, would be agreeable to everybody because you would like to benefit as much as possible and to harm as little as possible. So I don't think that would be very difficult to argue. And there's a lot of literature out there showing, in spite of the disinterest of Beecham and Childress, that are showing that non-maleficence and beneficence are part of common morality out there. When it comes to application of dose limits, I think this principle is related to, in Beecham and Childress terms, to autonomy and justice, because autonomy respects the individual person as a human being, and justice tries to not do two different things, let's say, to different people. If you look at it from a point of more basic common morality, I think we can find the concept of human dignity in all cultures, and I would be ready to produce the evidence. And also the principle of justice can be found everywhere. If you just look at the principle of reciprocity that is expressed in the Golden Rule, don't do to others what you want, don't want to do to be done to you, that is the principle of reciprocity or of justice, in which can be found really in every single holy writing of mankind and in oral traditions as well. So, my fifth statement, the three basic principles of radiation protection, justification, optimization, dose limitations, can be related to the four principles of biomedical ethics. And I do think that in turn, we can trace back these four principles to the common morality found in different written and oral traditions. Last point, could the common morality also provide guidance on other questions which are not covered by the three basic principles? And I do think we would get some additional insight if we looked at more broader common morality. First example, the unequal distribution of profits and burdens, which has been discussed sometimes. Sometimes we have the case that good is provided preferentially to one group of individuals and harm to another. And in this case, I think it would be useful to remember that many of, if not all, philosophical and religious traditions agree that special attentions must be given, special attention must be given to the underprivileged, which is, of course, not part of the basic three principles, but is common morality. It also appears in the theory of justice of John Rawls, who is, of course, generally considered a Kantian philosopher, but this bit, I think, is not particularly Kantian. It is coming from common morality. Social and economic inequalities are to be arranged so that they are to be of the greatest benefit to the least advantaged members of society. And I wonder what, maybe this is not in contrast to what we are doing, but maybe we could do it more conscientiously. My second example is, how can we take into account the risks for future generations? Different models have been proposed, some of them suggesting a discount rate approach in which future good and harm count less than prompt consequences. But the ICRP, no, sorry, in this case, the International Atomic Energy Authority, has stated that radioactive waste shall be managed in such a way that it will not, that in such a way that will not impose undue burdens on future generations. And there are similar statements throughout the IAEA publications. And I think that is very, very appropriate and very true, because if you look at cross-cultural ethics, then you find the principle of intergenerational equity everywhere. Intergenerational equity means that all generations, our own and the coming generations, have to be treated equally. Justice has to be done to all of them. So I think this is totally in line, but we can base it on a different argument. And my third example, some of you might not like, but still I would like to mention it here. ICRP still supports the LNT model as the most appropriate way of risk extrapolation to small doses, and this has been discussed here over again. But one particular aspect is that they say the calculation of the number of cancer deaths based on collective effective doses from trivial individual doses should be avoided. And I take issue with this trivial concept of trivial doses, because I think, especially if you justify it by saying that they are not biologically and statistically certain, then it is against the precautionary principle. Jacques Lauchard has spoken about the importance of the precautionary principle. So even if you don't agree with my particular issue with the trivial exposures, the precautionary principle certainly is a principle that you find in all the written and oral traditions of mankind, and we cannot ignore it. We should, even in the tradition of ICRP itself, and we should explicitly acknowledge that we consider it one of the basic principles of our system. So I do think, sixth and last statement, I do think that common morality can provide us with additional criteria for certain problems not covered by the main principles of radiation protection. In closing, I would like to stress that, of course, I do not advocate a total revamp of the system of radiation protection. I just suggest a different approach to its ethical foundation. This approach, this cross-cultural approach, would seem to be less biased towards Western philosophical tradition and therefore more acceptable for people from different cultural backgrounds. And it may also, if we really take it seriously, it may also give fresh insight into some problems which are difficult to solve in the current mix of utilitarian and deontological approaches in radiation protection. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, we take the questions of the sessions. Our next speaker is Abel Gonzalez. Abel Gonzalez has a very long career at the highest international level at the IAEA, UNSCEAR, and ICRP. He's currently vice chairman of ICRP. He also received the Sievert Award in 2004, and in connection of Europa, he was the vice president of Congress Affairs for the 2008 Congress in Buenos Aires. Please.
Thank you, Cisco. Well, first of all, it's a big honor for me to be in front of you again. And thank you for hearing me. To be the last speaker has a lot of cons. I mean, normally you have less time. Normally, many things that you're going to say were said already. But you have a pro, that you can criticize what the others have said. That is the pro. This meeting really on radiation protection philosophy, at least a part of it, and we use the word philosophy very openly in radiation protection. We have used philosophy for many things. Philosophy really contains at least three elements, one of which is discovering the nature of radiation and its effect. And this is, has been all this Congress about. And I will not talk about this. The other one, which has not been mentioned in the Congress at all, is figuring out what is known, really, about radiation and its effect, epistemology. And I will just show one or two slides on this, despite that, of course, my main focus will be in one part of philosophy, that is ethics, deciding what is right. And my personal view is that we should not revamp radiation protection, as has been suggested. Just the opposite. I believe we have to be proud of radiation protection in how we decided what is right. Epistemology, the second part of ethics, is concerned with the theory of knowledge of radiation and its effects, especially with regard to methods, limits, validities, and scope. And on that, I believe we have done little. And we know a lot about the truths, but we know very little about the beliefs, uncertainties, and judgments. And knowledge is really in the middle of the two. We should not forget that. Let's move now to the ethics of radiation protection that is the focus of our meeting today. Ethics is concerned with the morality of radiation protection principles for us. And for that reason, we don't know politicians to be radiation protection people. And but also, we should recognize that we should not only talk about ethics, but to really apply ethics in practice, and not like these students here. We have a long tradition on ethics, and Jacques mentioned the Thaler philosophy. We forgot that one of the Sievert lectures, the one of Cellini, was on ethics. For we have a long tradition. We have not discovered ethics yesterday. In Sweden, there was a very big impulse, Jacques referred also to that, in 2000 with the workshop of the Radiation Protection Institute. But I disagree that ICRP have not mentioned specifically ethics. In ICRP publication 82, paragraph D3, you will have the glance of many of the things that we are going to talk in this meeting. The agency gave a very interesting paper of ethics in 2005, the UNESCO precautionary paper just appeared, much before ICRP was talking about ethics. And then, of course, the NEA workshops in Finland and in France, I believe, were the two big elements on ethics. It's true that there are two orientations on ethics, and it's true that ethicists, that they said that they're incompatible among them. Social-oriented ethics and individual-oriented ethics. And I will try to show you that what we did in radiation protection is to make these things compatible, in spite of many ethicists. They said, if you are ethic for society, you cannot be ethic for individuals and vice versa. The fundamental doctrines of ethics, many of have been mentioned here, are the so-called teleological, which is the ethical of the consequence, the utilitarian, which is a derivation, is true, but I would prefer to treat it independently. The utilitarian is based on utility, which are the societal type of ethics. The deontological, based on duty, many Europeans believe that Kant has discovered this, and we talk of multicultural, believing that all these ethics are European, but frankly speaking, the deontological ethic has more than 1,000 years before Kant. It's the basis of the many religions, and these monotheistic religions took that ethics even for ancient Asian ethics. And finally, the ethic, the Aristotelical ethic, based on virtue, which is called virtue ethic, that has mentioned today. These are mainly individuals. For you have this societal and individual ethics. These are the basic doctrine in ethics going around in this moment, which I will put in this diagram. It will facilitate the visual impression of what we are going to talk then. Let's see how these ethical doctrines work vis-a-vis protection in general. The basic aphorism of consequential ethics is mind the good ends, which justify the means. Everybody said this is the ethic of the decision makers. The morality of protective action should be judged against the overall consequence of our actions. Utilitarian ethic, based on utility, as has been said, do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And the morality should be judged against his contribution to the overall utility, namely to the best welfare among all people. The deontological, the basis on duty, that is impermissible to kill one person to harvest good, but it's coming from this old religious statement, not do unto others what they should not do unto you. The morality of protective action should be judged by the duty to protect individual human beings. Remember that in the old monotheistic religions, human being was parallel to God in that sense, rather than by the overall consequence or utility. And here is where appear that there is incompatibility between these doctrines. And finally, the old Aristotelical ethic based on virtue, do good that will not be returned to you. The morality of protective actions should be based on virtuosity rather than consequence, utility, or duty. For let's remember this ethical aphorism in this diagram. Mind the end that justifies the mean, do the greatest good for the greatest number of people, not do unto others what they should not do unto you, and be virtuous, do good that will not be returned. And let's go to our principles. We know, we have talked about this principle many times, but what we have not said is that there is an intrinsic value of this principle, an intrinsic value of prudence, which can be converted, it's true, in another principle of protection of present and future generations and their environment. But they are inserted in our principle, we're always inserted in our principle. The only thing that the IIA have done was to extract this in a separate principle. And it's good to recognize that. This was done by the IIA with the blessing of the chairman of the ICRP at the time. He was one of the drafters of these principles. Therefore, the important thing is that this safety principle now has been blessed by the full United Nations system, is incorporated in international conventions that make them obligatory to countries. That is, I believe, the main issue. And of the 10 basic safety principles of these conventions, these four ICRP principles are there. One, that was these intrinsic values, have been separated as a separate principle, but the four are there. You know the principle of justification, and a decision that alters radiation exposure should do more good than harm. Justification is a balance between goods and bads. In nuclear power, it's usually said that the good is producing electricity, the bad is the thing that Fukushima can happen, and the release can go into the environment. And of course, the decision maker should ensure that good is more than bad. Not so easy. But it's also true that the justification principle applies to situations like this. Justification of severe countermeasures, such as evacuations, is this justified? This will be a good question to answer in Fukushima now. The principle of optimization is simple. Optimization should be best under the prevailing circumstance. And I use optimization with C, not only because I am from the West Hemisphere, but also because I believe this right in Latin. And you know, it's very basic. If we increase the radiation protection level, the social detriment increase, the radiation detriment decrease, and there should be some equilibrium between these two detriments and an optimal value for radiation protection. And the principle of individual restrictions, which basically said that dose and risk to any individual should not exceed limits, constraint, or reference level, depending on the exposure situation, meaning that individuals have to be protected individually against radiation and risk coming from all possible sources on all possible situations. And then is this intrinsic value, protection of present and future generation and the environment. Well, we have had this from years. You remember that for the reasons that after 1 year of practice, we know that doses will continue to occur after the first year of practice, we know that doses in the second year of practice will be really the dose coming from the first plus the dose created by the second, and after 3 years will be something like that, and in equilibrium will be something like that. And from many years ago, we are limiting the equilibrium buildup of those, the committed dose. For we have not ignored the future generations. It was one of the intrinsic values of our standards. And certainly, we discover, perhaps more late, but much less late than many other countries, but many, many international organizations, the protection of the environment. And maintaining biological diversity, ensuring the conservation of species, protecting the health and the status of natural habitat are our principle, intrinsic principles. Therefore, the protection principles are here the three that we have been defending over years now, plus this intrinsic value that, if you want, for visibility, you can say that this is a fourth principle, but it really is part of more three principles, and which involve this commitment to the future and the environment. That is the prudence. That is the prudence involved in our principle that was there many years before the UNEP principles of prudence. Four, let's see what we have. The ethicist said that the morality should be judged against the overall consequence. We have said justification. There is a direct parallelism between these two things. The ethicist of utilitarian ethics said that the morality should be judged by the contribution to the overall utility, namely to the best welfare among all people. And we said the level of radiation protection should be the best under the prevailing circumstance, maximizing the margin of benefit over harm. Direct correlation. The ethicist said that the deontological ethics, much before Kant, but reinforced by Kant, the morality of protective action should be judged by the duty to protect individual human beings rather than their overall consequence or utility. And we said inequitable protection options should be prevented by restricted individual doses with limits, constraints, and reference level. The ethicist, from Aristotle on, said the morality should be judged by their virtuosity rather than consequence, utility, or duty. And we said protection should be provided to both present and future generations and their environment against scientifically plausible radiation harm, even if it is uncertain. This is what ICRP has been saying. In summary, the ethic of protection is composed by justification, which is basically equal to the consequential ethic of the theology of the ethicians. Optimization, which is equivalent to the utilitarian ethic, individual restriction, which is equivalent to the deontological ethic, and prudence, which is equivalent to the artiatic ethics. In summary, my dear friends, I believe that we should be proud of the radiation protection ethics. Always we can improve, but please don't be critics of what we have to be proud. We have built an ethics from many, many, many years, and I feel personally proud, and I believe that all our profession should be proud of the ethics that we were able to build. Thank you very much for your attention, and thank you for your tolerance.
Thank you very much on the summary and also keeping the time. So I suggest that as we started a bit late, we will use a bit of the coffee break for discussion. And now all these papers are open for discussion, and I welcome questions to any of the speakers.
My name is Chris Haskins. I have a question to our first speaker, because listening to the need of the awareness of the ethics in radiation protection, especially in the medical domain, it was very clear to listen to. But basically, it's the same message as 25 years ago. I very much now link to the presentation of Abel Gonzalez. I very much support his idea that the ethics in radiation protection have evolved over a period of, let's say, 50 years or more. What can we do, is my question, what can we do to speed up the awareness of this ethics in medical protection?
I fully agree with what you say. I think there isn't an easy answer to how we can actually speed it up. I think what we should do is try and actually introduce it into training courses, so for not just for doctors, but for all health professionals, that there should be some teaching of this during their university or college courses. But I think the only way now that we can take it forward too is to have presentations such as these increasingly at medical conferences. And again, that's not easy because the people doing it don't have that much time always to be able to do it. But that's the only way I think that we can try and take it forward. But it's been slow, and I don't think that there is a rapid way that we can do it. But we have to go take steps backwards, as I say, I think, to introduce it earlier on in training and education. Yep.
My name is Gilbert Eckermond. I have a question to Jacques Lochat. You made a very interesting introduction to the precautionary approach, which is essentially related to complexity and to uncertainty. And we noticed at this conference that the biological and health complexity regarding new effects is greater than we thought before. And even we noticed, I referred to the panel with Wakeford 2 days ago, that our dose paradigm could be uncertain too. So my question is regarding precaution. Is it precautionary in radiation protection to essentially base or to exclusively base or those exposure assessments on those, exposure assessments on the concept of those regarding complexity and uncertainty of new effects?
I don't know how to answer to this question. It's a good question, but frankly speaking, I have to think about it.
It's a good question, but perhaps it's not a question on ethics. It's a question on epistemology. It's a question of the limitation of the science. And that, as I said, is something that unfortunately has been absent this Congress. Next week in Unscared, there will be a discussion exactly on that topic, on the limitation of science for attributing effects or for attributing or inferring risk. And that is something that has been absent of the discussion. But perhaps we need it for the next CIRPA, a session like this on that topic. I believe the ethic is a little separate. It's related, as all matter of philosophy. Epistemology is related to metaphysics, and ethic is related to epistemology. But I believe there are two different subjects.
Thank you. Brad Castles, Australia. My question's a short one to Abel in his role with the ICRP. Wonderful presentation to clarify how far we've come, subconsciously perhaps, with respect to the question of ethics and ICRP principles. Is there any suggestion that there might be a very simple document which captures this published by the ICRP at some point in the future?
Yeah, first thing that I want to say that perhaps ICRP was not so clearly in writing, but many people, I have not invented anything of this. If you look in the paper of Lindell, of Benningson, the Cellini that I mentioned, civil lecture, many of these ideas, Lawrence and Taylor as at the beginning, many of these ideas were there. I wrote this. Unfortunately, in Spanish, it is in the Spanish magazine of the society, Spanish Society, there's an article on this, and in an English magazine, but related to our local regulatory system. But as Jacques said, Committee 4 has, in this moment, a working group working on this, and I'm sure that they will come up with some simple paper on this.
Apparently not, so we soon break for coffee. But before that, I have an announcement. So those of you who want the certificate for attendance should pick it up today, because tomorrow the desk is closed.